Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Happy New Year. How you doing? I hope the first week of this new year has been good to you. We had a great intention setting workshop on the 2nd of Jan. It was really good. Well, apart from the fact that my whole internet went down. So that was fun trying to do a whole presentation on the phone. But yeah, it was a really good time to actually just kind of reflect on the year gone by and look to the next one. I think I've said many times, don't believe in resolutions, but I absolutely do believe in spending a little bit of time letting go of what you no longer need. So if you haven't done that, write a letter to 2021, write a heartfelt goodbye letter to 21 with gratitude, because it's always something to be grateful for, right? And then set your intentions as to you know what you want for the coming year. One thing that we've done in the Sober Club is encourage everyone to come up with their WTY. I'm sure you've seen that everywhere. Hashtag WOTY, word of the year. So what's yours? Well, have you thought about what your focus for the year will be? You can kind of think of all these fabulous words. I always want them all, actually. I always find it very difficult to narrow it down. But when you've narrowed down what you want your focus to be, what the theme is, if you like, that you want to kind of underpin what you want for the year, then narrow it down to 5, and then maybe narrow it down to 3, and then ultimately choose one. And we had some good ideas within our workshop too. Well, we've got the word, and we had some fabulous words come up. I'm sure you can imagine. Surrender was one, abundance, consistency, deserve. That was another nice one. But when you've got your kind of word, then do something a bit creative with it. So write a poem or create a song, or at the very least, create a vision board. Vision boards are amazing at the start of a year. Well, they are at any time, but it's a really good idea to, you know, just set your focus if you're still in New Year mode. I know some people are still saying Happy New Year and other people have had enough of it already. So anyways, what I thought would be great for today's podcast is to have a chat about family constellations. You've heard me talk about it a lot. It's my absolute new best friend over the last few months because I've trained in family constellations now. And I'm just really passionate about it. Many of you have heard me say the impact on family trauma, on childhood trauma, but also inherited family trauma, the impact that it can have on us, and how in so many cases it can lead to addiction, it can keep us stuck. And there is stuff we can do about this. And don't be confused into thinking that this is only relevant if you have a family around living right now. You know, we've all had a family at some point. And it's actually really fascinating the impact that it can make on us. So given that, you know, everything that we do on this podcast aims to help us kind of create a better life for ourselves, helps us to focus on that personal growth, I suppose you'd call it, and being able to be authentic and to like ourselves, then I think this does absolutely fit in with all the stuff I talk about. So as you probably know, I did a workshop last November, and I've got another one January 23rd, and I've teamed up with Rafe Nguyen, who's got years of experience in this work. He's been doing it a lot longer than I have, and brings just a huge amount of expertise in working with people with trauma and just about everything, actually. So I thought we'd have a chat with Rafe. This is a section of an interview that I recorded with Rafe when we did our Constellations workshop. So I thought it might be quite nice for you to hear how he introduces it. It's not the easiest work to explain. So I thought that would be good, particularly ahead of our workshop on the January the 23rd. But before we do any of that, I thought it'd be really good to talk kombucha again. As you know, I am a very big fan of keeping the ritual, changing the ingredients. That means you've got to be able to find something great to drink. And it's so hard to beat kombucha because it's actually good for you and it tastes fantastic. And I've become aware of the Nunk brand this year. And so I thought, you know, let's just actually get someone to talk about it who really knows exactly what it is, because you can hear me talking about SCOBYs for so long, but then you need the expert. So without further ado, here's Andrew from Nunk.
We're talking kombucha. It has become one of my favourite subjects, and I'm really chuffed that I get to chat to Andrew Mills, who is the founder of Nunk Kombucha. Andrew, we've spoken about your wonderful, wonderful kombucha before, but I thought it would be really great to have you describe it to us in a bit more detail than I can kind of ever really do it justice. But before we even do that, can you just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into starting this work?
Yeah, well, my background is actually in technology. And I think I just got to a point where I was looking to do something different where I could actually, you know, make people happy rather than, you know, always problem solving. And that at the same time, I was making this drink for friends and family. And my wife and I decided we would actually launch it, you know, to the masses. Yeah, and that was like, I think, 2 weeks before the first lockdown. So that's right. a whole nother story.
Yeah, absolutely. It's never the best time to launch a brand, is it?
No, it's not
the best time to bring a book out either, let me tell you. Just for anyone who might be new to this whole kind of world, as it were, just explain what kombucha is, and then we can look into why Nunk is a little bit different again.
Yeah, kombucha is a very healthy drink. It's a fermented drink. Kombucha itself is made by fermenting green or black tea and cane sugar. And the drink tends to be a little bit vinegary, but it's packed full of acids that are really good for your gut health, antioxidants, and so on. So from a gut health perspective, it's just a real sort of wake up call for your gut, you know, full of good health.
Yeah, a fantastic alternative to alcohol, you know, and I think I find a lot of people that had been drinking wine, particularly, try kombucha, and it's like, wow, not only does this hit the spot, it's good for me. Like, what's not to like? And just describe for us this fabulous word, the SCOBY. Just tell us a bit about that.
I think it's an extremely attractive thing. My wife,
yeah, it looks like a jellyfish, doesn't it?
my wife's not so keen. Yeah. SCOBY stands for a symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast. And essentially the way kombucha is produced is this: you add the SCOBY to your mixture of sugar or green and black tea. And then the SCOBY, which is the bacteria and yeast, work together to convert the sugars into acids, well, they convert to alcohol, which is then converted into acids.
Which is why it's good for you, despite containing sugar, because it's pre-digested, as it were.
Absolutely, yeah. And most of the sugar that you use during the fermentation is actually consumed during that process.
Yeah, and when you mention it turns to alcohol, just explain that piece for anyone who's thinking, oh no, don't tell me it's alcoholic.
Well, if you brew it at home, there's probably a good chance that it is slightly alcoholic. With kombucha, if you're brewing it at home, you could expect it to be up to about 1.5%.
But oh, really? Oh, okay. So yeah. You have to watch the levels.
Absolutely. And the more, if you do a second fermentation, which is where a lot of people do the first fermentation, and then do the second fermentation when they add flavorings and get the natural carbonation, that's generally where it becomes alcoholic. So I would always recommend to people, if they're brewing it at home, they should just, you know, try to avoid the second fermentation and stir it as much as possible. The bacteria, right, which consumes the alcohol and converts into acids, it loves oxygen, while the yeast doesn't. So stir it every day, twice a day, and that helps promote the bacterial growth and bacterial activity, which also keeps the alcohol levels down.
Yeah. And so tell us about your brand then, because, you know, it's often referred to as the champagne of kombucha because it's this specific type. So just explain it to us.
Yeah, well, we believe Jun kombucha, which is what we produce, is the original kombucha. And, you know, there are some people out there that will say it originated in the Himalayas and that monks and spiritual warriors roamed the grasslands of Tibet and they were the first to brew it. I don't know if that's true, but Jun is one of the most unprocessed or natural drinks I've ever come across. It's very similar to kombucha. It's the same goodness, if not better, because the main difference between it and kombucha is that it's made by fermenting always green tea and raw honey, never processed cane sugar like kombucha.
Wow. So just tell us, I mean, how come the raw honey then? How do you even get hold of that?
Well, we started Nunk. We look after bees in our backyard, and we started Nunk using the honey from our own bees.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. And I remember that. That's fantastic. Yeah. I love the whole idea of that.
It's fantastic. Well, it's a whole other, again, a whole other story talking about bees, but they're just a real great way to get in touch with the environment and sustainability, et cetera. So, and the honey is just so good for you. So it's not processed. We never let the honey get above beehive temperature. So all the goodness is still inside it. And the Jun kombucha, the SCOBY that is used in Jun kombucha, is especially made, or that's not the right word. It's there. It feeds on a diet of raw honey. It wouldn't survive if it was fed on sugar. And likewise, it feeds on green tea. It wouldn't survive if it was fed on black tea.
Right.
So it converts the raw sugar, breaks down the sugars in the honey, and the same process kombucha turns into acids, which turns into alcohol.
Yeah, amazing. And you've got these lovely flavors. So tell us about the flavors that you've created, because again, with kombucha, it can taste so completely different depending on what flavor you have. It's like a different drink altogether.
Yeah, absolutely. And I you know, for me, one kombucha brand will taste completely different to another kombucha brand. There's some great ones out there. We have four flavors, four core flavors. Two of them, Hops Monster and Rose Blush, are both won Great Taste Awards. Hops Monster is our version of an IPA, a lager. And some have described it as being better tasting than most non-alcoholic, a better tasting beer than most non-alcoholic beers. And it's made by kombucha, which is then flavoured with various botanicals, hops, coriander seeds, cardamom pods, etc. Rose Blush is a floral drink. It's got a rosé colour. It's got this aromas of, you know, red berry, hibiscus. It's just a lovely, lovely growing up soft drink. It's probably the best way to describe it. And our two other flavours, are new flavours that we released late last year. One is Mango Buzz, which is our sort of can of goodness. I mean, drunk kombucha is already good for you, but in Mango Buzz, we've got the mango, we've got turmeric, ginger, and peppercorns to sort of to increase the effectiveness of the turmeric. So it's a real, really good for you drink. Start your day, lunchtime, kind of pick me up. And our final drink, which is a surprising drink, is Chili Cha-Cha, which is Scotch bonnet chilies with mango and pineapple.
Oh, wow. I haven't tried that one. So no doubt that's got an actual kick, right?
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised. That's why it's quite surprising. You get I describe it as settling into an old lounge chair, an old sofa. The first couple of seconds is a bit uncomfortable, then your body sort of adjusts to it and it becomes very comfortable. So you get the initial tropical flavours coming through, but then you get this warmth on your neck, which is just delightful. So it's for some, that even people that don't really like chili, they can taste it and they'll go, oh, that's too strong. But then I say after a couple of sips, they're like, yeah, you know, my internal organs have adjusted. I quite like this now.
Yeah, it's so brilliant that you've managed to do this with all these fantastically good for you ingredients. And also, you know, we must say that what's unique about your brand too is that we can actually get it in a can, which is really funky. You must be pleased with all your packaging and everything. The way the brand looks is great.
Yeah, thank you. Everything's come together quite nicely. I mean, we starting it with, you know, the reason we went down cans to begin with, apart from the environmental concerns, was that we were going to be in festivals and events and so forth. And obviously they all got cancelled with the lockdowns, and we decided to continue doing the cans because they are so good for the environment. And also I think from a space perspective, they're much better in the fridge than bottles and so forth. So I think there's only a few kombucha producers in the UK actually using cans. And I think it's, you know, it's just a nice way to consume a drink.
Yeah. Well, we wish you all the best, Andrew. It's a great brand. Thanks so much for sharing that info with us. And I look forward to trying that chili one. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Janie. Thanks for your time.
So check the show notes, and if you go to thesoberclub.com, you'll find a competition there, some more info about the brand and a competition to win some. I think we've got a whole case to give away, so check that one out. And as promised then, let's hear from Rafe Nguyen on family constellations, and bear in mind we've got an event on Sunday the 23rd of January. If this is, sounds like something that you might be interested in, just click on to thesoberclub.com/events.
So, Rafe, you have the fabulous job of introducing yourself and then explaining a bit about family constellations, maybe for people who literally have never, really have no idea what it actually is.
Okay. So I'm Rafe Nguyen, and I've been doing this work for quite a few years now. What got me into it was that my second wife was dying of cancer, and I had always been someone who... felt responsible for everything. You know, it's the sun's shining today because you know, I'm in a good place. Obviously, it's my fault. So when my wife was in this situation, I found that I couldn't hold it, and so I went to get help. I went to a psychotherapist, and within two sessions, he said, "You need to go to a constellation." And the reason that he did that was because he could see that the boundaries that I was holding were about me, were nothing to do with the problem, that the boundaries of the problem were beyond me, and therefore I had to look outside of myself. And that's why I went down to a constellation. I went to see Richard Wallstein in London, and I did, the first session blew me away. The second session, I just thought, I've got to train in this. This is just magic. And the what constellations is that you're allowing your history and your all the epigenetics, if you want to go scientific, the epigenetics of your existence to be displayed. So you're letting out the bits that don't belong to just you. I mean, I have, you know, hazel eyes. They don't just come from me, they come from my family, my history. But some of my attitudes come from my family, some of my, you know, some of the trauma that comes from my family. I have German Jewish history in my past. I have McGregor Scottish history in my past. And they all contribute to who I am. And some of them, those things are fantastic. Some of those things are wonderful and very useful to my daily life. And some of the things are really not useful. Mm. They're really, you know, they're desperately bad for me. And therefore, to know where they belong, to see where they belong, and to hand it over to where they belong is just such a beautiful, easy, simple thing to do. I'm 70, and I don't want clients to come for every week for the next 10 years. It's not my bag. I want to be able to put something in which helps somebody today, and they go away and they're different, and they, you know, maybe they come back to me with something different in a fortnight's time or in a month or 2 years or never. You know, it's all fine. And the way it displays, there's a fantastic Netflix program, Sex, Love and Goop, with Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, and they did a session 5, wasn't it?
That's right. Mm. And she does. There's a constellation going on in there, which you just display it very, very adequately. And she uses the I hadn't heard the term before, but she terms the people who take part in a constellation resonators, and it's like they're resonating with the part of you that's holding. You know, I mean, I have part of my mother, I have part of my father, I have part of my grandfather, my great-grandfather. All those things are within me, and I'm holding them. And for somebody to, if I give permission to the field, and the field is this space here that we set up to look at our family system. And when I give the opportunity for my field to be displayed, what I'm saying is that I give this person, the resonator, an opportunity to resonate as my mother.
Mm. I think it's important to kind of stress that it's, you know, it's not psychodrama, it's not role play. No. The first time I did a constellation, you know, as a representative or a resonator, which is a great word, I was kind of nervous. Oh my goodness, I'm going to have to be acting, but it's absolutely not that at all. And then it's actually quite surprising the first time you do this work when you kind of when you realise, okay, I am getting some information here that's not from me. It's absolutely not from me. It's not within my own experience.
That's exactly it.
And that's when the word magic might come in. But as you say, it is actually, it does have a scientific basis.
Yeah.
And we should talk about the fact that this was founded by Bert Hellinger.
Yeah.
Just tell us a bit about his work.
Well, he was a Jesuit priest who did some missionary work with the Zulu tribes in Africa. He spent 16 years down there. And what he went there with the ambition of bringing them into Christianity. But actually what he found was something rather different. He was a psychotherapist as well. And what he realized was that the community, which in those cultures, in tribal cultures, is almost always intergenerational. They always recognize, grandparents, great-grandparents, ancestors. You know, they're all part of the picture. So there's never the individual. And with psychotherapy, particularly in, Western civilization, psychotherapy is about the individual. So that you've got the psychotherapist who's the expert and the client who's the person who's looking at their stuff. And what he realized was this community of ancestry and elders and tribal leaders and things like that, they all interacted in a different way. So, for example, you might find somebody who was going to have a baby, and they knew that that baby was going to be a warrior or a healer, and the way that person was looked after would be different because of what they realized was going to happen. And their education would be different, their feeding would be different, everything would be different. And he realized that there was something going on here that was a bit more than, you could call it magic, but it is actually quite straightforward. We do resonate with people. We do, you walk into a shopping center and you feel, I don't like being here today. That's fine, but you're picking up on something. Mm. What he noticed was that people were picking up on the community. And therefore, he developed it into a strategy for helping people to understand what's going on in their ancestry from a Western perspective, where we have no obvious recognition of that.
Mm. That story. It's interesting because, there are a lot of people who would, initially they would say, well, I'm estranged from my family, or I don't... Mm. I don't see my family, or I have a very difficult I have a very difficult relationship with my mother, or
yes.
We all have these various stories, and there are people who would like actually to feel that they don't have any need for that. They don't have any need to be associated almost. But Bert Hellinger talks about the orders of love.
Yes.
And actually the family of origin, really, whether we like it or not, is very important, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the orders that he noticed were things like the patterns of growing up, things like the first period of your life is kind of nurturing time, where a child is utterly dependent for at least a few years, and therefore you could call it mothering. It doesn't have to be a woman, it doesn't have to be the birth mother, but it needs to be done. That nurturing, because otherwise the child doesn't survive. The next period is kind of, you might call it fathering time. It doesn't have to be a biological father, it doesn't have to be a man, but it has to be done. And it's introducing them to the world, so they begin to understand, what's going on out there. And then the third sort of section is, with boys it tends to be more like the boy has a fight with the family and leaves and starts his own new system somewhere, and the girl becomes more as a friend, confidant of the mother. So they become there are secrets between mother and daughter in those situations. That's a design feature, if you like. But one of the design features that goes on in those orders is that we're designed to, if you're a man, be a bit like your dad and marry someone a bit like your mum. Doesn't mean you don't have to be gay. You can be gay and, you can marry someone who's a bit like your dad, even if she's a woman, she can be a bit like your dad. That those are the design features. Now, we rebel against those things because they're not working. We rebel against those things because none of us are perfect. We've all got these flaws. So the what he also noticed was that there were things going on in a way, like we all have an absolute right to belong, so that nobody has a superior right, and yet in our families' histories and in our world, we find that that's not completely true. So we have to work towards it. We also find that things that came before have to give up space to things that came later. For example, when I arrived here this morning, there were three women sitting out there. Now, if there were only three women here, we'd have more space. But they had to give up space for, you know, 15, 16 that are here today. So it's just a fact of life, and nobody's arguing with it here. But in a family system, they might be arguing with it. So, for example, a second child comes along, and the first child has to give up space for that second child. So they may have some, you know, there may be some complication in that. Mm. And those orders affect how we behave and how we manage those things.
Yeah, and it's interesting, of course, that so many of us carry stuff, you know, from childhood, or some of it from our childhood, some of it inherited, from generations that we don't necessarily even know anything about. You know, we carry stuff. But then in so many cases, you know, what happens is we don't deal with that. We just push it down, or we don't even recognise we have anything to even look at. Some people don't even know there's anything. But even if we do, we just push it down, or we assume there's something wrong with us.
Yes.
Which is why, you know, so many people end up with addictions or issues or whatever it might be. And, you know, just tell us a bit more about the link there and what tends to happen.
Well, what happens in family systems is there's a kind of balancing act going on, that we tend to go for balance, actually, whether we like it or not. And when something is, say, for example, there's a child dies in one generation, and the parents are, you know, they're tragic about it, but they're so horrified that they can't deal with it, and therefore they don't talk about it. It's not mentioned. So the eldest child from that family is actually the second child or the third child. Mm. It's not he or she is not the first child, and therefore they carry this burden. I mean, people here will know whether they're the oldest child or the middle child or the youngest child. They will know that. But they might be wrong. Mm.
There might have been someone who's not been noticed.
If you talk to somebody who's the middle child, or there are books written about the middle child. Yeah. There are books called the middle child. You know, but if you're not the middle child, or if you believe you're the first child, but actually you're the middle child, you're carrying the burden of the child that died.
Yeah.
And you will be surprised how many times I've come across a situation where the child that survives is named the same as the child that died.
Mm. So they're adopted. Their place was really never honoured.
Well, worse than that, they're standing in the place of someone who died.
Right.
And therefore they're carrying the burden of being dead. And when their mother looks at them, I mean, you know, say they're, you know, called Fred, and, you know, she's standing at the back door calling them for supper. Fred, come in for your supper. Who's she calling? Mm. The one who died, or the one who, you know, is she yearning the child that died? And that, those feelings, that empathy, that energy comes with us. So we carry that burden.
Which is, of course, why so many people feel they're not enough, they're not worthy, they don't have the ability to have self-esteem and self-love.
Or even worse, want to be dead.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So you get suicides that follow those scenarios, because people feel that their place is being dead. Mm. And therefore, in honour of their family, which is the most important thing for them, they decide to commit suicide rather than challenge the family system.
Yeah.
Now, the beauty of family constellations is you can see all that, realise where it comes from, and deal with it, let it go. And it's, you know, my analogy for letting it go is always about the coffee cup. If I let it go, I have a broken cup and a mess on the floor. Whereas if I hand it on, it goes somewhere, and I don't have to deal with it, and I don't have to clear up any mess.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of regime.
Yeah. Also, you know, to follow on that kind of theme, you know, in many cases you see children whose parents are splitting up or, you know, divorcing or whatever, particularly if it's very acrimonious. And in almost every case, the child believes it's their fault.
Yes.
And tries to carry it.
Yes.
Because as children, we do, I suppose.
Well, I mean, children have a reasonable idea that before they came along, their mummy and daddy got together and were in love, and that after they came along, they were a bloody nuisance, and that they therefore they must be the cause of the challenge that their parents are facing. It seldom really is. Or it never really is, I would even hasten to add.
Yeah, yeah. Just explain just a little bit more for us, as best you can, how constellations works in the sense that, you know, as you say, we set up the field. Just explain, if you can, what that means.
Well, the field is the energy you're carrying of your family system. We all carry it, whether we like it or not, whether we know it or not, whether we're experiencing it or not. But what happens is that somebody will be burning to do some work. They'll come and sit here, and they'll map out the kind of important people that are pressing on them in their mind. So it might be, there will be obviously them, probably a mother, probably a father, and possibly somebody else. You know, it could be a grandparent who looked after them. Maybe their parents died when they were born. You know, those things happen. So there will be other people. So you've got somebody who's aware of, say, four people. So we ask them to choose people to resonate for them. So they'll choose somebody to resonate with them. So they'll ask somebody to, would you mind being resonating for me? And what happens is that, by the way, if somebody doesn't want to resonate with somebody, that's completely fine and completely normal. There's no pressure. If you don't feel like it, say no. It's fine. There's no judgment about it whatsoever. You choose somebody else. And it doesn't much matter. And the resonator gets almost as much from the workshop as the client. It's not a thing where the client gets it all and, you know, everybody's working for them. It's not like that. It's a much more immersive experience. So they choose somebody. When they choose somebody, they put their hands on their back and move them to a place that feels right. Now, if you haven't done it before, it sounds weird. It sounds a bit, really? I mean, how do I know what feels right? But we've, in Western civilization, we've got to used to this being the source of all our information in our head. And we therefore believe that we can, know where somebody... And actually what happens is the belly, where it's your instincts, your gut feeling that moves you. And what happens is you carry on moving until you don't have an instinct to move anymore. And you leave them there. And then you maybe it's your mother you're looking for. And by the way, women can represent men can represent women. It really doesn't matter, because sometimes what somebody's resonating is the internal feeling of that person, and that's got nothing to do with gender. It's got to do with feeling, and therefore the next person again they put their hands on their back, move them to a place that feels right. Try to ignore what's already been set up rather than saying, oh, well, if she's over there, she should be there or he should be there. It's not like that. It's more like this feels right, and you micro adjustment sometimes matters. You know, this is different to this. And it just don't know why. And then so you've got four people standing up in the room, and then the client sits down. And they can move around, but make sure that they, find a comfortable place where they can see what's going on. Because it's really important for the client to see it expressed outside. So what they've done is they've given permission to the field of energy to display what's going on in them it's not at this time exactly. It's a sort of amalgam of their life journey. So it's not as a child, it's not as an adult, it's just them. And what happens is when these four people are standing up, the facilitator will begin to notice maybe some interaction, maybe some awkwardness, maybe some you know, somebody's looking over their shoulder at somebody else, and they pick up on those things. The facilitator's job is to just see those things and to mention them and to ask perhaps what's going on with mum, or, you know. And what happens is that the resonator feels some inclination to say something if they're asked.
Mm.
And what they say is odd in Western civilization. It could be something like, I don't like standing here. Well, you know, we're in King's Langley Cricket Club. You know, we're sitting in a circle of people that we, you know, want to be with. So why would you not want to stand there, and you do want to stand there? And what you're doing is you're stepping in to the frame of this client's field.
Mm. Yeah, it's a difficult one to describe to actually do it. But I mean, I know the very first time I went to a constellation, I was the very first thing I was asked to do was represent death. And of course, my own ideas were, oh, I don't want to, how do I represent death? Do I have to? I immediately kind of took myself back to my acting days and thought, you know, oh, so now I have to be, how is death? Should I lie down? Am I dark? Am I, you know, it was bonkers. Whereas actually, I was shown that you don't have to do anything, nothing at all. Just stand in the field and see what happens. Just stand. And immediately I realised that I actually was completely neutral.
However, as a facilitator, I would notice that journey that
to get
you went
there.
To get there also represents death, and it represents the journey into death,
yeah.
Which is scary. What do I do? How do I do it? You know, what am I supposed to look like when I'm dead?
Yeah.
All those things going on. I'm an actor. What, you know, how do I behave? So it, you know, you. That the thrilling thing about constellations is that everybody represents perfectly. You know,
yeah, you can't get it wrong.
You can't get it wrong.
Can't be wrong. No.
You know, I've had real skeptics who really didn't want to be there, being asked to represent somebody's grandfather, and he stood up and they said, "Oh, I don't want to be here." And the client's going, "Oh my God, he's exactly right."
Okay. So, is anything else you'd like to share? Just generally about, you know, about constellations generically, and I mean, you must have seen some incredible experiences and successes in inverted commas over the years with people's lives completely changed.
Yes, but I'm also using it as a tool for other pieces of work.
Yeah.
You know, money mindsets and matrix and things like that, where people are needing to deal with stuff that's very present in the moment,
yeah.
Isn't really about their you know, for example, with the money mindsets, we look at what was going on when you were a little kid, what words were around when you were a kid, how did you, you know, what did money look like,
grow on trees,
no, exactly. all those concepts that were added to us, and you can use the constellation model to unpick those,
yeah.
And open it up for then doing some other work.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't have to be about deep trauma from your childhood.
Exactly.
Absolutely. One of the
That's
most
right.
fun constellations I was ever part of was someone who really was thinking about changing career.
Mm.
And it was just absolutely lovely that within a very short space of time, the field showed her exactly what the work that she was meant to be doing. You mentioned there, you know, other sort of tools, and both of us have also trained in something called Matrix.
Mm.
Do you want to give a quick description of what that is? Because it so often pops up within this work.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, Matrix is a visualization that helps you to reframe a trauma. I mean, if there was a road accident outside and five people saw it, the police would get five different stories.
Yeah.
The colour of the car, even the number of people in the car, even all those things would be different for those five people who witnessed it the same time. And therefore, reframing it to get, you know, for example, somebody might see that the person who got out alive, wow, that's amazing. I saw the most amazing thing today. Somebody had a car crash and they got out of it you know, without a scratch on them. How amazing is that? And other people who had a road accident themselves feel traumatized by seeing something happen that was similar to what happened to them. And therefore, reframing it into that, isn't that a wonderful thing that you survived? And what happens with Matrix is you go back to a time when something happened, and you, because you can visualize it, you're there with them. Mm. And when you're there with them, you can educate them on the fact that, for example, for most three-year-olds, something bad happens in the family, they feel like they're going to die. You know, that the instinct is that they're not going to survive this unless they get supported. Whereas you can go to them as your 2021 version of yourself and say, actually, we survived. I've got kids, I've got grandchildren, I've got, you know, whatever's going on in your life. We made it. Mm. You didn't die. And they go, oh, wow. Mm. All right. Okay. Well, we'll look at this differently. And it's a kind of domino effect through their life. So you can set it up with, and what I found is that going with constellations, you can go into a great-grandparent's history, which you didn't even know who they were, and yet you can go in there and visualize that space, what was going on for them, and just adjust the way the dominoes fall.
Mm. And I think just briefly, we should just say as well that one of the things that I found most profound when I first started doing this work was when you realise, you know, the stuff that people carry and the trauma, and whether it's with a big T or a little T, you kind of, particularly if you've got your own children, you start to think, oh my God, what the hell have I done to them, kind of thing. You know, I remember thinking, oh God. But the interesting thing is, as the practitioner I work with said, you know, the more work you do, the less they have to do. Because this work, even though it might only be you doing it, as opposed to all of your family or your children or whatever, something of that it has a ripple effect.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely, mm. Yeah. I mean, I'm aware that if my parents had done some things, then I probably wouldn't be a constellation facilitator because I wouldn't have needed to.
Yeah. You know? Great. Okay, thank you. And just give us your website, Rafe, just for the purposes of this recording.
Rafe.website.
Okay.
It's easy as that.
So I hope to see some of you at our next Family Constellations workshop, Sunday 23rd of Jan in Hertfordshire, thesoberclub.com/events if you think you might be able to make it. It is fascinating work. If you're doing Dry January, by the way, meant to mention that earlier, well done, because you're, you know, a little way in now. And keep going. You know what I'm going to say. Don't focus on what you're giving up. You're not giving up anything. Only focus on what you're gaining. Actually, keep playing that tape forward and thinking about the benefits that are to come for you. And start to get excited about what you're looking forward to as you move forward. And the first few weeks can be hard. There's no denying that, because everything's all over the shop. Your brain chemistry doesn't know what's going on. Eat super well, be kind to yourself, stay connected. That piece is just mega important. Do make sure that you check in with someone, tell someone else who's got your back. And of course, you know, if you can join some kind of tribe, some kind of connection, you will hugely benefit from that. You know where we are at the Sober Club. You know how to find us. Have a great week. And we've got some great guests coming up on the podcast, by the way. Excited to tell you I've interviewed Veronica Valley, author of Soberful. So looking forward to bringing that interview to you. I've got some great guests lined up. And if you do have any suggestions for me, always happy to hear them, particularly if you can connect me with said person, even better. So you can always just drop me a message. Look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.